The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.
Of the bills passed through the Missouri House of Representatives so far this legislative session, only a handful have already gotten a Senate hearing. One of those is House Bill 301, which contains multiple provisions related to crime, but the one that's caught the most headlines is a provision allowing for the appointment of a special prosecutor to address crimes in cities that meet a certain murder case rate. So currently, St. Louis is the only city that meets that criteria. On this episode of Politically Speaking, the bill's sponsor, Representative Lane Roberts, joins the show to talk about not only the special prosecutor portion of the bill, but the bill as a whole. He also gave his opinion on a different bill that would place control of the St. Louis Police Department under a state-appointed board. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and Politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me via Zoom in St. Louis is my co-host, St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And our guest today, joining us in studio in Jefferson City, he represents the 161st District in the Missouri House, which includes Joplin, Missouri.
Lane Roberts.
Thank you so much for being a guest, a first-time guest, and because of that, you're going to get the first-time guest treatment, which basically means tell us a little bit about yourself and what you did before you ran for the Missouri House.
Well, actually, most of my career has been a complete accident. I graduated from high school in 1966, which means I'm a grown-up now, never intending to do anything except join the Air Force because my dad had been in the Army Air Corps. So I spent 4 years in the Air Force, but while I was in basic and tech school, I had an opportunity to participate in what they called the student leadership program. And ultimately, before I got out of tech school, I was actually responsible for 460 airmen. It was my first experience with command, and I rather liked it, frankly. I spent a couple of years over in Southeast Asia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. Came home in 1968. Went to Edwards Air Force Base where they did all the flight testing. It was a horrible place to live, but a great place to work on airplanes. And while I was there, I spent some time assigned to what was called the Air Police Augmentee Program, basically like a police reserve. My first experience with it, and it actually turned out to be somewhat prophetic. When I was discharged in 70, I became a police officer in 1971. I had been working on a cattle ranch. I enjoy horseback riding. I was a bona fide cowboy, straddled a cayuse and punching doggies. And the owner's stepson was a member of the sheriff's posse. Now, in 1971, that was more of a big drinking club than anything else. But he told me about this test for the sheriff's office, and I could not begin to tell you today why I took that test, but I succeeded. Everything I knew about law enforcement came from the TV program, Adam 12. At that point, the future was foretold. So I spent 43 years as a police officer, 28 of it in Washington State, 8 of it in Oregon, and 7 years as the chief of police in Joplin. And I was in Joplin when the tornado came through. When I retired in 14, I had an opportunity to serve as the state director of public safety under Governor Jay Nixon. An interesting experience. He's a Democrat. I'm not. But I got to know him fairly well during the tornado, and frankly, I like the man. He allowed me to run my department according to my needs. We had lots of conversations, but he was never what I would call directive. When I retired from public safety, when the new governor came in, I moved back actually to a different district, which turned out to be 161, which was the tornado zone. And so I'm representing the very area that probably was one of the most life-changing experiences that I've ever had. I'm very honored to be there. And this is my fifth term in the legislature.
So, wow. First of all, that is a very eclectic background, to put it mildly. We ask that question to every guest, and that might be like the most impressive background I've ever heard. It's good to butter you up before we, you know, hit you with hostile questions.
Well, some of us don't object to being buttered up either.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you had all this experience, and now you're a Missouri legislator. What has your 5 years in the House been like compared to all this other experience that you've had?
Actually, it just turned out to be relative. Frankly, when I came to the legislature, it was my intention to somewhat distance myself from public safety because I didn't want to be viewed as a one-trick pony. That was an exercise in futility. The truth of the matter is that's just my wheelhouse. That's what I do. It's where I have the most to offer the legislature. So much of my the bills that I've sponsored or bills that I have participated in are public safety related. I came up this year fully intending that I would sponsor 8 bills, and that was it. I'm now on number 13. Because there are just a lot of worthy issues. It's difficult to say no. But a highlight, an example of why, I mean, I'll be 75 years old next week, and I get to do this. How cool is that? How many people get that opportunity? But there was a bill last year that created a lifelong protection order for victims of domestic violence. And there was a woman who testified. I won't say her name because I don't want to embarrass her, but I will tell you that she may be the most courageous human being I've ever met. She fought a serious abuser for 10 years, had to go back every year to get a protection order, spent $42,000 of her own money, and still this person was a threat in her life. So I was able to pass a bill that did two things. One, it changed the definition of stalking to include technology so that people couldn't get into your phone and your computers and do the online humiliation that some do. And then secondly, it created a findings of fact list that if a judge found those facts to be true, he could issue a lifelong protection order against the abuser. And so she no longer has to go to court to renew that. The abuser now, if he ever wants that lifted, must prove to the court that he has been rehabilitated. And so the onus is on him now and not on her. She no longer has to be in the same room with him to be able to get her protection order. She's able to testify in camera if it came to it, and so can other women who are victims of abuse. And while I think I've done some things that I feel very good about, if I never did anything except pass that one bill, my time in the legislature has been worth it. It's an example of how you go about remaining relevant and meaningful, even as you get a bit older. I enjoy the fact that I'm still making a contribution that has some value to other people.
Speaking of bills that you're handling this year, you know, you have handled House Bill 301, which has a number of provisions aimed at stopping crime. Before we talk about the special prosecutor part of the bill, which we are going to talk about, just what are some other provisions that you think are notable in the bill?
Well, House Bill 301 grew out of a request from the Speaker's office to form a bipartisan committee and do what he referred to as a deep dive into crime. And very specifically, asked us to look at both urban and rural crime. Very specifically asked that it be truly bipartisan. So it was a 6-member panel with 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans. Out of that grew the bill that you're going to want to talk about, but also truth in sentencing, which is a very big deal to the sheriffs, bail reform that mitigated that sort of a ricochet effect that people are having now when they go to jail and they're back out on the street within the hour. There is a provision in there for the police academy be able to reimburse people who attend the academy and then subsequently get a job and retain it for 4 years so that they can recover their investment. It costs about $6,000 to attend the academy. And when the person is finished, there's no guarantee they're going to have a job. And so some of the people that I think might have the most aptitude don't ever apply because they have often families. You know, somebody gets in their late 20s, they've got young children. At that moment, retirement is not the issue. The issue is putting food on the table. So for them to incur a $6,000 debt with no guarantee of a job in the face of supporting your family is a difficult decision. So hopefully that bill will allow them to recover some of their costs. It's not a bill regarding St. Louis, regardless of what people would like to think. There was also... And I'm sure we'll talk about this more. In that bill, in our discussion of crime, there was the question of kids with guns. What do you do with that? Now, I have taken no small amount of heat for looking into that. It's kind of sad, if you don't mind my diverging just a bit. When I was running for office, in every single meeting I went to, without exception, somebody would say, "We just want somebody who's honest, somebody who would tell us the truth." And they meant it, unless, of course, my truth differed from their truth. And so what happens is, you know, you don't agree with me, therefore you're a racist. You don't agree with me, therefore you're a gun-grabbing rhino. You don't agree with me, therefore you don't appreciate the homeless. And that's just the reality. I'm happy to report that getting to know some of the people in the legislature, there are more people up there who make decisions based on their conscience than party than people would like to believe. But it is very difficult. We have almost a fanatical defense of the Second Amendment, and I'm one of them. The Second Amendment is so uniquely American that it's part of our international identity. Nowhere else in history or in the world have people given themselves the right to keep and bear arms. However, it was not meant to authorize 14-year-olds to walk around with a Glock 40 in their waistband. That's not what the Second Amendment was about. So trying to craft language that would somehow prohibit that kind of conduct while not treading on the Second Amendment or infringing on it anyway has proven to be very, very difficult. When you say gun on my side of the aisle, people immediately get wary that you're going to be encroaching. And before the committee hearing was even out on that, there was somebody on a podcast, and somebody whose character I have very limited appreciation for, calling me a rhino and a gun grabber and so forth. You know, when you make decisions that are conscionable, when you abide by your conscience, occasionally you'll disagree with people. And if their response to that is to name call, I'll just live with it. This is more a question of honor than it is party affiliation. The truth of the matter is that a 12-year-old has no life experience to understand the consequences of what he or she might do with that gun. It's not a question of how smart they are. You have a constitutional right to vote, too, but we don't let 12-year-olds vote for the same reason. We don't let them drive until they reach a certain age, or smoke, or drink, or do a variety of things that really have more to do with maturity than rights. So I'm still facing that challenge, frankly. 301 is over in the Senate. I think it has an opportunity where there's some compromise yet to do. I'm hoping that at some point we can craft language that will bridge that gap between the need to deal with what these young people are faced with, deal with the difference between urban and rural culture when it comes to firearms, and still preserve our support of the Second Amendment.
Okay, so can you explain what you actually want to do with juveniles and guns? And can you also explain a little bit more why there's opposition within your own party to it?
Well, I don't think the opposition is to the question of kids with guns. I think most of them understand it. What they're concerned with, and I knew this from the very beginning. I mean, this is a swim against the current. You do things with the best of intentions, and then find out you have unintended consequences. And I think the concern here is that we will do something to deal with a specific issue that would somehow undermine or erode our support for the Second Amendment. I get that, and I even agree with it to some extent. It has not been an easy thing. So the opposition as such, I think, is more concerned about the impact on the Second Amendment and our support for it in this state. We may be one of the most conservative states when it comes to the Second Amendment. That having been said, the reality is that especially in urban areas, and maybe I should make that distinction, in the rural areas, kids hunt, kids have guns. Their parents frequently provide them with a firearm, tell them a bit about hunting safety and things of that nature. I certainly did. I mean, I received my first rifle when I was 8 years old. But my father taught me how to handle it, taught me about responsible use of it. I would submit to you that the 12-year-old with a Glock 40 in his waistband didn't get that kind of guidance. So there is a real difference between what happens in the urban and rural areas. So if we craft a bill that addresses the question of kids with guns in the urban areas, do you run the risk of having unintended adverse consequences to rural areas? My intent right now, frankly, is to give the police something to operate with. Because of the nature of Missouri's laws regarding firearms, we have constitutional carry. There is no requirement for a concealed weapons permit. Police officers don't have the ability, even when they recognize somebody with a prior criminal history, to address their possession of a firearm. There is no prohibition, especially if they're a juvenile, because juveniles are not convicted of felonies. They're adjudicated delinquent, and that's not provided for in the law. In St. Louis, we know that we have adults who are, in fact, criminals who don't want to be caught with a gun. And so they're in the company of a juvenile with whom they have provided a gun. And they will often have that juvenile do the work for them or gives them immediate access to a firearm. Should a police officer find that young person with a gun, at this point, the only thing they could conceivably do would be to take that individual home and turn them over to their parents and then relinquish the gun to the parents as well, because there's no crime committed. It's not evidence of a crime. So what I am hoping to do is find a way where the police can do something proactive to be able to take a firearm until we can return it to a lawful owner. Frequently, these guns are unfortunately stolen. And take guns out of the hands of some of the young people we know have contributed to the crime problem, who are still effectively children and have not had the chance to get the guidance or the life experience to understand that they're doing something that's going to affect them the rest of their life. It isn't just exclusively a question of dealing with crime. It's also a question of making sure that you're looking out for the future of these young people. But it has proven to be a very elusive response. We're still working on it. I've got some high hopes that maybe there's some language on the horizon that might address this. But somehow it has to bridge the question of urban versus rural, Second Amendment versus public safety. And you know, it's kind of like the house itself. When you sit down at the desk, you get two buttons to push, yes or no. Unfortunately, most of what we deal with on the floor is neither yes or no. It's somewhere in the middle, but there's no 80% button.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's State House and Politics reporter, Sarah Kellogg. Joining me is my co-host, Jason Rosenbaum, political correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio. And our guest today is Republican Representative Lane Roberts, who represents the 161st District, which includes Joplin. So we're going to get back into House Bill 301, which is indeed the special prosecutor part of that, which, I, as you know, is getting all the headlines. We're a part of that. So let's get into it. So why do you think that the governor should be able to appoint a special prosecutor to handle crimes in St. Louis?
You know, when we first started this discussion, I've had several people. In fact, I was asking the Senate committee, who put you up to this? Who told you to do this? Well, the reality is nobody told me to do it. In our discussions in a bipartisan committee, we understood that what's going on, particularly in St. Louis, not exclusively, but particularly, it's the best example of it, there are an awful lot of people dying, and the people who are taking their lives are not being held accountable. There are literally hundreds of homicide cases that are being, that have not been prosecuted. It's the perception, whether it's true or not, I will leave to other people to make their own mind up. In my perception, it is true that the existing circuit attorney is far more willing to prosecute police officers than she is criminals. But in the final analysis, I frankly don't care who the circuit attorney is. There is this prevailing thought that somehow this is a racist or Republican move to control St. Louis and to attack the first black female circuit attorney in their history. And I understand, having spent some time with this bill, now why people believe that, and I understand the sincerity of their belief. It isn't true, but they believe it. And you don't make somebody believe something they don't, nor vice versa. I understand that as well. I don't care who the circuit attorney is. I don't care what gender they are, what race they are, how tall they are, what size shoe they wear. I just don't care. What I care about is that a lot of people are dying and the people who are taking their lives are not being held accountable. And I've been told, well, you're an outsider, you shouldn't meddle in St. Louis. And I adamantly reject that. I'm Missourian. And those are Missouri lives. I've been told, well, we elected her by wide margins twice. How can you possibly overturn the will of the people? Let me suggest to you that the people who voted for her twice are not the people who've been victims of crimes wherein their perpetrator is still running loose to commit more crimes. The idea behind the special prosecutor is not to usurp them. If they want to reelect her, fine. But people who commit homicides need to be held accountable. And what's happening in St. Louis, if it were just confined to St. Louis, I guess I could probably find a way to live with it, though it would be very distasteful. But the truth is that what's going on there is spilling over the borders, not only affecting the surrounding area in terms of its crime and things they have to deal with, but it affects Missouri in general. If you talk to people outside the Missouri borders, and you say Missouri, they think crime-ridden state. In Missouri, you say crime, and they're talking about St. Louis. This perception of our state is affected by St. Louis. St. Louis loves to lay claim to being our economic engine. I don't deny that. But there is a certain amount of responsibility that comes with that title. What happens in St. Louis affects the rest of us, our national reputation, our international reputation, the willingness of people to bring their businesses to Missouri, the willingness of people to send their children to our academic institutions are all adversely affected by the crime rate. That crime rate is driven disproportionately by what happens in St. Louis. So for those who say I'm meddling in St. Louis, I would argue that I'm looking out for the interests of Missouri. Specifically, and very specifically, the victims of crime in St. Louis. I spent my life involved in protecting people from others who would victimize them. And there's nothing anybody's going to say to me that tells me I have no right to look out for the lives of innocent people.
Well, one of the groups that disagrees with you is the association that represents the prosecuting attorneys in Missouri. And they're a pretty powerful lobbying force. And I haven't like listened exactly what they have to say, but I guess it's because they think it sets a bad precedent. And if you do this in St. Louis, you could do this pretty much anywhere. How is that going to affect the trajectory of this bill if you can't get the prosecuting attorneys across the state on board with it?
Well, I think obviously, I mean, that's a force to be reckoned with. I know many of those people personally. And, you know, from the very beginning, when you talk about the Second Amendment, you're treading on pretty sacred ground. When you talk about prosecutors' independence or discretion, you're treading on sacred ground. And I knew that from the very beginning. It was never my understanding that prosecutors were simply going to follow along like a bunch of ducklings. That's just not their nature. They don't like this, and I understand why they don't like it. Given the opportunity, I would certainly find a different way, but I've yet to hear an alternative that has any immediate effect. I have had lots of dialogue with members of the Prosecutors Association. I think we're moving closer to some kind of an understanding. I hope we are. But the fact is that what you said is true. They're a powerful lobbying organization. They're very smart people. There may be some exceptions, but the majority of prosecutors are pretty darn smart people. And they work hard, and they have a sense of responsibility. I'm not going to speak for the organization. I suspect, however, that if you were to have a discussion with prosecutors individually, they wouldn't tell you they were big fans of what's going on in St. Louis. But I'll leave that to them. My responsibility at this point is to do what I can to mitigate it. I'm doing my very best to help them, help me craft language they can live with. And as I said, this bill is not done yet. There is still compromise on the horizon. There's still some language that we think could happen that might make this doable. I think we're much closer to achieving success than perhaps we might have been when I first started out. We'll just have to wait and see. I'm just not willing to throw in the towel because I have a formidable enemy. That's the wrong word. Opponent is probably a better word. They are formidable, but I'd like to think I'm not a chicken.
You know, I'm sure you and our listeners know that Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner is facing a quo warranto effort from Attorney General Andrew Bailey. If Bailey's bid to oust Gardner is successful, would that dampen enthusiasm for the special prosecutor provision of your bill?
My fear is it would, and that's unfortunate because it's not a solution. As I said, this is not about a person, despite the effort to make it one. From the personal perspective, if she were ousted, what prevents her from running again next time and getting reelected? It's not a solution. The solution for me is that we have a mechanism in place that allows the governor, when things get out of hand, to step in and make a state contribution to making it right. The provision needs to outlast my tenure in the legislature. It can't be a temporary thing. And I've spoken with some of the legislators from St. Louis, and they've been very candid with me, and I have the greatest respect for some of them. They don't like it. They don't like it. And I get it. I understand. I can't tell you why I like it, but I think it's necessary. My effort right now is to work with them to find something that, albeit they don't like, maybe they could live with, and vice versa. Maybe something that's a less than what I had in mind, but I could live with it because it gives us some kind of solution. But simply ousting the existing circuit attorney, first of all, I don't think is a solution. And secondly, it was never my intention to get focused on removing her or anyone else from office. I just want to be sure that victims of crime get their justice and their day in court.
I want to move on to what I think is the other major crime-related measure that's moving through the legislature, which is a bill establishing a board that the governor appoints overseeing the city of St. Louis's police department. What do you think of that idea?
Well, for many years, we had state control of St. Louis. Folks have said, well, it was just as bad then as it is now. I would disagree with that. I think St. Louis's crime rate today is the worst it's ever been in their history. I guess my question is, would we be in this position had we retained state control? There has been a steady erosion in the crimes. I looked at a piece the other day in one of the print media, spoke to crime within 1 mile of the arch. Crime is up something like 2,700%, 2,500%, gun-related crime in general. Prosecutions are down. Arrests are down 90%. That's going two opposite directions and leaving St. Louis in the lurch. Does state control solve the problem? I think that in conjunction with a special prosecutor, it could certainly team up to improve the situation significantly. There are resources available who are not subject to local politics. Every local jurisdiction has some level of that. I've worked in both city and county, and now state. And I think there is a political influence in almost everything. Anybody who tells you that this would not be subject to political influence is not being realistic. But is it subject to the less direct political influence of local government? It'd be pretty hard to argue otherwise, and my experience has not been that's true. We have in St. Louis a very progressive-minded leadership. I guess I find myself asking if we're progressing in the right direction. Just because you're progressive doesn't mean that we're making progress. I think arguably some of those progressive policies are failing pretty significantly, which is why we're where we are. So, you know, do you solve one problem but leave the other influence? My heart says no. But in answer to your question, I am less focused on that piece of it than I am on the special prosecutor's piece. But I think the two in harmony could have some beneficial results.
So I know what you mean by the fact that a lot of municipal police departments are not directly overseen by the elected leadership of those cities. I would imagine this could be a short answer. The mayor of Joplin was not responsible for overseeing you when you were police chief. It was probably the city manager. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So the downside of that, though, is that city managers are not elected. And the idea is if you don't like the crime policies in St. Louis under local control, where the mayor's office essentially oversees the police department, voters could retaliate by voting against them or voting against their aldermanic allies. What would be the sort of public accountability under state control for the citizens of St. Louis that would be similar to that?
Well, just as Kansas City currently has, there is a board, which in the case of the legislation currently moving in the Senate would include the mayor, who has the same responsibilities without the element of election. Now, let me just tell you, I'm not arguing with what you're saying. There is validity to what you're saying. But just as my vote on the floor is difficult there, because there are no yes or no answers, I can't tell you this is a silver bullet that solves all the problems. But in comparison to what we've seen happening over the last decade, my conclusion and the conclusion of many others is that the experiment in local control, at least with regard to the police department, has been a fairly dismal failure.
You know, one of the other alternatives to this is what St. Louis County does. St. Louis County's executive does not directly control the police department. There is a board of police commissioners that is appointed by the county executive. And for the most part, and there's been some bumps in the road on this, it's not a perfect system, but the St. Louis County Police Department is generally seen as a very well-functioning police department. Why not just set up a similar system where the mayor appoints the commissioners directly instead of the governor? Why does it have to be the governor appointing this board that oversees the police department.
I think you're pointing out something worth considering. I guess the argument is you still have the progressive policies that would lead to appointing the board. And so do you appoint people who subscribe to your way of thinking? I would agree. I've had some interaction with it, limited by, let's just be honest, but limited with St. Louis County. I think that everybody understands that their crime rate is significantly different than the city of St. Louis. There's lots of influences on that. It's not exclusively a question of how they're governed or how they perform, but there's a significant difference. Conceptually, what you're saying is pretty much like state control, except on a local level. And again, you have the more immediate influence of politics on a local level than you do on a statewide level. I don't want to be seen as arguing with you because that's not my intent. I think that the discussion about which is the better approach is merited. I mean, you raise good points. I don't have easy answers. I think you raise good questions. I just, I, like many people, don't have that single answer that would satisfy your question.
That is all the time we have. Thank you so much, Representative Roberts, for joining us on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can follow all of our coverage at stlpr.org. Representative Roberts, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found, if at all?
Yeah, the easy place to find me is on the House website. That's house.mo.gov. Everything is there, every bill we're working on, the bill string, what's happened with it. You can also, on that website, you can bring up debates on the floor on particular bills, who sponsored what, what'd they actually say as opposed to what are people claiming they said. It's the best way to do it. And in that, you can find a link to my particular page that speaks to the bills that I have, and you can email me anytime. Call my office. I'm happy to speak with anybody. For the sake of forewarning, I'm happy to answer questions. I'm not willing to sit and listen while somebody insults. And there's been more than a little of that, and I'm not tolerant of it. I will answer any question anytime if someone is actually interested in my answer as opposed to being insulting.
All right. Until next time. So long.